Let's see. This is some session. I don't know what number it is, but it's Mormon Epic. And my name's Bob Reese, and I am delighted to be here. In Wyoming, they tell the story of the farmer who was pretty much indifferent to religion, but he saw a flyer posted around different farms saying that there was an itinerant preacher who was coming to preach a sermon. And so he thought, well, he had harvested his crop and of hay, and so he thought he'd take time and go. So he went to the big tent that was set up and came in, and there was no one there except him. So he took a seat right in the front, the first front row, and the preacher got up and looked out and saw just this one person and thought, well, I came here to preach a sermon, and so I'm going to preach it. And so he did an hour of a fiery sermon and ended with a big flourish, and the farmer just kind of stood there. So the preacher came off and came down and shook his hand at himself and said, what did you think of the sermon? The farmer said, well, I thought it was good, but you know, if I was out and I had harvested a whole load of hay and I took it out to feed the horses and one horse came, I'd be damned if I'd give him the whole thing. On the other hand, on a more poetic line, you will get the whole damn thing here. But Milton, one of Ron Wilcox's favorite poems.
One of my favorite poems.
Poets spoke of writing to a fit audience, though few. So we're glad that you who are here are part of that fit audience.
How do you remember these things? I just don't.
You make them up. It doesn't make any difference whether you said it. You make it and sound like you did.
What do you need to be a university professor or something?
At 5:30 this morning, as I was sitting in the Oakland airport waiting.
And it was 5:30, which is,
this very morning. As I was sitting in the Oakland airport waiting for a 6:30 flight to Salt Lake, I was impressed with modern technology because I pulled out my iPhone, which my kids say, Dad, you really don't know how to use that thing. But I just typed in Ronald Wilcox Multiplicity. And on this little screen came a poem that I had received when I was editor of Dialogue 40 years ago or so, a poem called Multiplicity, by a poet I'd never heard of named Ron Wilcox. And you know, when you're editing a journal, you get a lot of things, and a lot of them you slog through, and a lot of them you feel sorry about the person who wrote them because you've got to reject it. And sometimes you get something that really kind of wakes you up. And Ron's poem, Multiplicity, was one of those things. It was a lovely poem, a wonderful poem. And so I accepted it for publication in Dialogue, and had kind of lost track of Ron over the years until my friend Clifton Jolly called me and said he and Ron had made friends. I lived in Dallas, and that Ron had written a poem called A Mormon Epic that I should know something about. And so Clifton put me in touch with Ron. Ron sent me a copy of this book here on the stand.
We'll hold this up right now.
Called Mormon Epic.
Mormon Epic.
And I started reading it, and I was
6 pounds of poetry.
Double-sided.
Bob called me last night and asked me if he should bring his copy.
Yeah.
And I said, what chance is there that Ron will show up without his?
Oh, you know me so well. Please continue, sir.
Anyway, as I read this poem, I was, to use a scriptural phrase, sore amazed. Not sore from hefting it or reading it, but sore amazed and really amazed at the poetry. Ron Wilcox writes in the way that you want every poet to write, which is in his or her own unique voice. And when I read Ron Wilcox's poetry, I hear echoes. I hear echoes of Anglo-Saxon poetry with this wonderful alliteration, the assonance and the consonants and the internal rhyme, which is among the most powerful poetry in our language. But there are also echoes of a lot of other poems. One of the things I appreciate about Ron's poetry are the freshness of metaphors. Aristotle said, the surest sign of genius is the ability to make new metaphors. And Ron's poem is full of wonderfully fresh metaphors, wonderfully expressed. Some of you may know of a little-known poet whose name is Christopher Nolan. Christopher Nolan was a young boy living in England who was what the English at that time, and maybe still do, call a spastic. He had multiple muscular dystrophy. He could not speak. He was paralyzed. And everyone except his mother thought he was a cipher, thought he was just nothing there. But his mother looked into his eyes and said, I see something in Christopher. When he was about 12, they were able to get a what they call a unicorn pointer to attach to his head so he could, by very slow and methodical tapping on a computer computer keys, type out what he was thinking. Out of that came a book called Dam Burst of Dreams, that the dam burst. All of these dreams that this boy, all of this poetry, that, you know, when I read reviews of it, people were talking, saying, you know, he was like Hopkins, he was like Yeats, etc. And I thought, well, of course, that's very extravagant. But then when I read Dam Burst of Dreams, I thought, all of these words kept inside this young boy, when he could finally find a way to express it, came out in such an incredible flow of beautiful, mellifluous, strange, and yet strangely beautiful language. I had something of that same sense when I read Norman Epic, and then said to Ron and to Clifton, maybe we should try and devote a session of Sunstone to this poem. So that began all of the things that have brought us here. Richard Wilbur, one of maybe our best living poet, has a wonderful poem called In Praise of Summer. Obscurely yet most surely called to praise, as sometimes summer calls us all, I said, the hills are heavens full of branching ways, where star-nosed moles fly overhead the dead. I said, see how the sparrow burrows in the sky. And then I wondered why this mad instead perverts our praise to uncreation. Should it not be enough of fresh and strange that trees grow green and moles course in clay and sparrows sweep the ceiling of our day? This mad instead that we who write poetry and love poetry are caught up in, this mad instead perverts our praise to uncreation. And then the wonderful thing about that poem is that when he's saying, why do we do this? He can't escape it. So the last line, as sparrows sweep the ceiling of our day, so the sky and the ceiling and sweeping all this becomes mixed in this wonderful way. Someone said, poetry makes nothing happen. We are here today to give the lie to that.
You're here.
Clifton.
Thanks, Bob. Ron and I, our poems met before we did, because I think, I'm trying to remember, but I think my poem, Prophet, was published in the same issue of Dialogue as your poem, Multiplicity.
But I didn't get in nearly as much trouble for Multiplicity.
That's true. That's because no
and
one could you, understand.
Your tribute to Eugene England is also in the same dialogue as a poem. The
line. Oh, really? I see.
We just keep bumping into each other.
All these paths cross, and Ron would get in more trouble if more people could understand what he says. I'm certain of that. And some of this verse as you listen to it. You won't, you probably won't catch the meaning of it, and it doesn't matter, because what first enthralled me with multiplicity, which I still don't think I can really understand, and certainly with this, is the musicality. Dylan Thomas used to say that poems should be written aloud, that they have to be heard. And as soon as you've heard Ron speak, whose life has been in the theater as well as in the world of letters, where he has written plays, had plays produced, has been an artist in residence, has lived the life I wanted for myself. But you begin to hear the song that is his poetry as he speaks. What will impress you when you see it on the page is that this is blank verse. It iambic pentameter. The form of Shakespeare, the form of Milton. To show you how little I understand this, I chided Ron because he liked Milton so much, and he said, "I was being ironic." I said, "Thank God." "Then we agree," I said.
Oh.
And I remember when I studied Milton, reading that because he was going blind, the last books were dictated to his daughters, who never forgave him the task. And it always seemed impossible to me that he could have dictated those wonderful, wonderful lines. Too many of them, perhaps, but nevertheless wonderful. Until I first heard Ron speak. And then it seems to me that if you have that voice and can really hear those words, that there are things that you probably can write that you can't write if you hear them being chirped by someone like me. And so that's why I've asked Ron to be the first to read. And I've selected a section which he didn't select himself. The rest of the poem he chose for himself, but he didn't choose this section, which is actually the introduction. And it's what first blew me away about the poetry. And the reason is, it's the first time I've ever gotten my head around this thing called creation, you know, and got some sense of just the wild, huge musicality of that great event. Ron has given me that. And the other thing he has given me is confidence that it may in fact be possible to write a great Mormon epic poem, which I was persuaded was impossible by Craycroft's epic poem, which we both remember with some great guy, if anyone's related. Awful.
Wonderful man,
much promoted by his brother, my department chairman, once upon a time. Both great guys. But if you read much of that verse, you came away with the idea that maybe Mormons shouldn't be writing long stuff. Well, I don't have the same respect for all of Ron's verse that I have for the parts I really, really like. But the parts I really like, I like as much as I've ever liked any poetry.
Well, what don't you like?
Never mind. Some of it I cut out.
All right.
But
the part about Milton is what you're getting.
Yeah, I cut out Milton.
Oh, okay.
And then the final thing is that so many of us live our lives and we never really give them to anything much at all. You know, we work, we go to church, we raise our children, we love our husbands and our wives, and we never have this overarching sense of passion for a project, for something that we work our entire lives on. And I told Ron when I began reading it, I said, it's wonderful, but who's going to read this damn thing? You know, it's so long. He said, well, I've got an idea for that. And he does. He's got a lot of ideas on why that's going to happen and how it's going to happen. He's just crazy enough to think there's an audience for this. And as it turns out, there's an audience of about 10 people, maybe more. Yes, there we go. And so I'm so happy that the readers are here, that you're here, and afterwards we can compare notes on the parts we like best. Ron
is going to talk about the writing of the poem, and then we will do a round robin reading.
Of pieces selected by Clifton or Ron?
Ron made the initial selection, and then I went through and said, this will never do. I did exactly what I've always cursed editors for doing to me. But the good thing is that there's so much good that Ron has, and because there's so much of it, that once you've edited, he doesn't really know what you've done. So it all worked out just fine.
Something's missing.
Yeah.
Is it my turn now?
It's your turn.
Okay. I've written a Sunstone introduction to Mormon epic, 381 pages of epic poetry.
Now, is that version in the tercets?
It's in the tercets, which, according to Bob Rees, is that they're in tercets. I didn't know the word until I looked it up.
This is what confused me at first, because I couldn't figure out where his line breaks were. You know, and it was Hopkins, wasn't it, who said that the poet should clip the lines where they naturally break. And so I kept trying to read these lines to figure out, well, why were they clipped where they were clipped? I did that for days. And then I talked to Ron about it very late in the process. And I said, there are iambic pentameters. Why are there three lines? And what was your answer?
You can just see them like little images.
Yeah.
All at the same time.
His idea is that this will eventually be on the internet, that it's not a poem that should be printed like this, but it's on the internet.
I like to pop it onto a small screen, and you can just take in the tercet, boom.
And so you can just see it, you know, right there, boom, 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 and you're not so intimidated. Well, it was a bad idea, Ron. This is the way it's supposed to look. The way I've printed it, in iambic pentameter single line stanzas. Thank you very much.
Well, you put it on the page and you end up with a very long, heavy book.
Yeah.
Homer didn't know anything about that. He was blind. He was talking. he popped these things out. His audience listened to them, and they listened like people listen to a soap opera or see a soap opera on TV. You have no idea how long this is going on. A plot is going on and on and on.
This is another reason why it could only be a Mormon poem, because it takes a saint to edit him.
Okay. I'm going to read the introduction I've written. I have an elder brother named Keith Wilcox. He designed and built this very building we're sitting in. He also designed this building.
Describe it for the recording.
This is the Mormon Temple in Washington, D.C.
One of the pretty ones.
And yeah, it's a beautiful temple. Thank you. He's 90 now. I talked to him yesterday. has more physical infirmities than ever he anticipated or deserved. That's all our stories, of course. Those of us who last longer than anticipated. He lives less than 2 miles away. According to his beloved wife, Viva May, he keeps telling the same old stories over and over. That's what I've tried to do with Mormon Epic. Tell the same old story over and over. Keith has been a thorn in my side ever since he returned from World War II. I was 12 years old at the time, and Keith never seemed able to just let me be. Little brother Ronnie was always the object of his positive criticism, whether it be where on which side I should part my hair or whether I ought to study medicine instead of poetry and drama. Whenever I was around him, I felt like I was somehow had become Keith's project, being a bedrock recalcitrant of historic Mormon stock. I did not appreciate being Keith's project. I let him know that in no uncertain terms. My complaint just never seemed to register. He went right on advising me what I should do. I went right on doing just the opposite. In other words, I've experienced 65 years of Keith prodding me to be better than I am. Deep down, I always wanted to excel my big brother. Deep down, I realize it's not really in the cards, but I tried very, very hard. Mormon Epic is a testimony of a brotherly competition, more on my part than his. I wanted wanted to write a poem. That would be metaphorically. Where's the picture? There it is. Let me hold it up. I wanted to write a poem that would metaphorically. Thank you. Like a beautiful white marble temple. I have no illusions who won the competition. Without Keith to harass me into being better than I am, I could never have written the epic poem we're reading today. I like to think I may have a decade more that I can complete, God willing. Two more epics. Mormon Epic 2, Brigham, and Mormon Epic 3, Mormons. I wrote Mormon Epic 1, Joseph, not on a paper page, but on a computer screen. The computer screen is a scroll, not a page. I discovered, at least for me, this fact may change some of the ground rules for written literature. Back to the future, as it were. The epic, long in time, when narrated aloud, next to impossible to read the entire poem silently, physical length in one sitting. My computer tells me that Mormon Epic in a printout comes to, I think you asked me, to, okay, it comes out to 18,944 words, 2,282 stanzas, and 381 pages. Neither epics nor short poems are read much, if at all, in our time. Presented on hundreds of paper pages in the form of a book, Mormon epic would die of our standard neglect of poetry. Nevertheless, a form of the epic can be experienced in individual, free verse, tercets, some linked in sequence, some separate in focus. In Mormon epic, each stanza is secure in itself, not standing alone, but clear in its context. Joseph Smith's life. Like the multiple disconnected segments used to advertise an upcoming movie or TV series, the poetic form here is fragmented, fitting into the present electronic maelstrom. The bard is heard, the subject covered. The tercets, however, are not in overall Gutenberg sequences. Rather, they are like short takes on a tiny computer screen. They can be absorbed like TV commercials, sporadically, with visual and sound bites intruding at every point. With Windows Media Player, it might be tempting to a hip Mormon youngster who already knows more than you do about the internet. The electronic screen they carry in their pocket might just appeal to a post-Gutenberg generation. Time will tell how it all turns out, but for the nonce, one of my favorite words, meaning for the time being, for the present occasion, for the nonce, at the end of today's reading, I'll be glad to answer or try to answer any questions you may have. Thank you for being here today. So, we begin.
First reading.
As soon as I take a slug of water. Non-alcoholic, I'm a
vodka.
Book one, Quantum Gospel. Take a patch of chaos circling beforehand. Sling it past black stars circling at random. Create light in rings inside particled sparks, glowing in random points and recognitions, moving and brewing beneath your own hand. Respond to word of God inside your mind. Call the involvement creation as the eyes of the gods. Gaze infinity into finite forms. Symmetry into exact reflections of love. Had I reckoned further, I would have wakened a dream of being born inside my mind. Had I known my urging soul, inviting my eyes to behold myself, admitting a verge of sky, had I been born a babe unto regenerations, electric with crackling insights and intuitions, I would have borne witness to the holy soul, whipping like lightning the spark embedded, the rumbling inside, my own seething vortex. Where did I begin? Beside the counsels of God, the intelligences swarming like flaming bees, about the instigations of the centered glory, unfettered as multicolored gardens explode in waves of flowers, streaming, beaming leaves, vanguards of redeeming impulse to be living, the very air alive with incessant buzz of love, the desire for good and sheer deep believing, redoubted in swarms informed by beauty alone, heaven gleaned as home, taken as a given form of loving. Father and mother, intent on feeding the baby beam, redeemed from an infinite river of flashes, flowing by the garden of belonging, the place of becoming,
the seed of my being, where I began, uninformed and searching to see my harvest of options, returning upward to the sun, redeemed to become one with the hovering spirit, the beginning of all beginnings, my beginning.
From Sacred Grove, the enfolded codes adorning a morning sun in streams of creation radiate into this boy who gathered his questions in sacks of veils, kneeling among green energies above him, simply ask Father why and who to trust when all the voices he heard combined and dimmed, when not knowing why before he was told is a razor splitting open those closed skies. Admitting bright answers as from new sun, Joseph looked over a wooden crooked fence constructed by his own hands for his father, listened fervently to the meadowlark's echo, that far cry wherein his God could hear him. Nearby he knew a sacred grove, all his own, ringing and enshrining, with gleaming leaves being melded into shadows of ancient truths, where he could tell the sky secret to glorify straightforward, uncurving rays of knowledge. They stood still as double suns above the boy, smiling down upon his knee-prone amazement, his simple faith, the fiery center unveiling truth, as tangled amid the ebbs of withdrawing tides of mankind, confounded by knowing too much, centers of affirmation in forms he recognized. Like as his father and brothers and of himself, in a moment knowing more than all consigned before, in sentient convening of human minds. I know I need my father's love, as Joseph did, how I hold a word sacred as a piece of bread between my fingertips, how water is blessed, how I believe I fit an overview of everything with no limits on imagination, how I comply with promises I made as I was ordered with an emergence. This celestial symmetry breaks, organized into miracles of crystalline lattices, atoms emerging bright chips in my own form.
From Prepositio. To be an electric light that flares as it dies, to wind time in the spring of an old clock, I follow Father the Mormon epic to now, lighting my signs and ticking my missives. I say my story is true and Jesus Christ alive, that a daytime forever, Joseph Smith told, saves the best for last to be again foretold. In visions and blessings of old news made new for the one last time in shining words. A time before mine in the only view I know, limited in the long telescope turn round, as if removed further inside my tiny visions, to see vast landscapes finely sharp far off, as if self-same scenes inside my own brain, grasp my feeling senses and shape inside my soul those signals sent in flashes along the wires of my spirit, pinging in the mist. Time gone by, muscle of mind responding. Flowing inside the iron rod, Levi's dream, beholding a tree behind an icy mist of death. Life itself growing in the tree, seen as being a grasp of roots clasping into the ground, deep in Kimura, sheening plates, golden leaves, new revelation, old as time known only to God as continual, now, in daytime, forever, dreams made real, Joseph's mind.
From Invocation, I'll try, Father, to listen my way to an epic. I sing of visions long ago foretold by Joseph, retold in the telling this epic mosaic song, how Joseph found the golden secret inside. So my eye becomes a word I find within me, a word among sounds, of a word made real, word of the interim world we know as Earth, preexistent in the world we knew as a word, song of our Father's Son, our elder brother, Christ our Lord and only name under heaven, contradicted by iconoclasts and Mormon exes. What view do I have then, born among men? No superhero I, nor unbending theologian, no many-tricked magician or strict logician, no, no Moses I, no burning bush to tell me I am that I am. He who is has a mission for you to fulfill. Water into blood. Now you see it, now you don't. Card trick of leprosy and leaping lizard off a staff entwined with air. Would that I could, but I can't, is all I can say. I intend to do what was done millenniums ago, when epic words were sung among believers.
Now my time is an electric firestorm of icons, infesting video screens and evil burns in eyes unconsumed by the glare of lies made real. Appearing before me and telling me I can't be more than a scribe to the new millennium of writhing snakes, blood to water, rottenness. As a compost kicked up by confused gospels, false doctrines abounded in Joseph's time. Misunderstandings made men unamazed, just as the first lie, "Am I my brother's keeper?" makes murder for fun appealing on screen. Glittering in echoes inside the pixels dancing, the sex tees undressed and celebrated as joy. 50 million babies crushed in the rush to sin. The Torah shredded to waste underfoot, dust. As a voice from the dust speaking to us now, out of the ground to whisper out of the dust, words of the faithful dead out of the dead and dust, divining a living word as a sacred wine. So to Joseph then as now, our broken branch, springing from a vineyard springtime vine. So to Joseph, son of Jacob, and Joseph Smith Jr., son of Joseph at Palmyra, tending to boughs prophesied to yield a new fruit everlastingly.
From Enumeration. I see through a glass darkly to light, beyond my mortal ability as mere man become Mormon, be it Miltonic or Homeric or free verse-wise, I stylize my words as they go through my mindset heavenward, knowing full well my dim limit of life that flickers like an electric light, bright and dark at intervals, places inside my fleshy brain a burn of spirit, and time winding down in all my turns of winding, until I can say, this is what I say, and this is what I know. Of all I've seen and known, so help me God. So much for me, my word being bendable by daytime light known only by me as mirrors or clusters of fragments dropped, and each reflects sharp edges of parts of what I see. So I need whole insights into all I say of these immense vistas of time behind the telling of how Joseph came to be, one man made ready to testify of all that came before and all that is to come, of man and woman made one in God. So much for me, my word being bendable by daytime light, known only by me as mirrors or clusters of fragments dropped, and each reflects sharp edges of part of what I see. So I need whole insights into all I say of these immense vistas of time behind the telling of how Joseph came to be, one man made ready to testify of all that came before and all that is to come, of man and woman made one in God.
Were I a Greek singer of epic song, I'd plead polyhymnia, ancient muse of sacred poetry, to fortify my mind in paradigm and archetype, I need to say in song what has so long been described in particulars. So being a modern Mormon man, amazed, I must call upon thee, Father, for more than I myself am capable, so I may show amazing days of restoration, so I may render clearly the soul of meaning, song in turn of the sun and glow of the moon, in stars illumining lights of Joseph's mind, Urim and Thummim, delving diamond deep, flickering in deep lakes inside, revelations like sparkling shafts and beams rise upward when set upon with amazement the depths beneath these histories, engraved in gold and told in brass, a time so few knew of before, discerned in seer stone's pure translucence. Attend me in my words, O Heavenly Father, for I must go farther than I've gone before to tell the story of a great hero. I need thee. I speak in a time when no hero is given heed, no hero outside of fiction deemed to be real, a Machiavellian machination seeming true, cluster about the bones of murdered words, when all names are false and full of smiles. Deriding the truth is the way to recognition.
This section tries to capture Joseph going into the grove with all of the confusing doctrines around him and his kind of simple yet open mind trying to understand this. Pastors rant about matters concerning men, pay heed to each other's clever opinions, set like verities astride the Bible, and claim truth as what they say, best most smoothly defined. Joseph wonders which is the way to heaven. Predeterminations to death seem to him nonsense. Babies sent tumbling into fires of oblivion, committees constructing what the Lord has to say without a hint of direct verification. So the holy priesthood enters the loud fray without his being fully aware what will be his place in a plan he knows no one knows. Neither he is a boy who can simply wonder, nor words beyond his ability to make clear, claims of learned men contending in letters instead of plain sense and patches of disdain for meanings made simple enough for the 14-year-old boy to consider his own. Priests reveal schemes counter to Christ, ancient misgivings flung about carelessly as fiats fly like pottery through stained glass caricatures, doctrine derived through guesswork, alien creeds wound like broken threads into patchwork fabric covering secret sins, while celibacies mistaken for chastity and bedeviling themselves with whips, Adam's body denied. No wonder Joseph was hated for asking why.
What did Joseph not know he had to find out? A boy amongst tumults of opinion and firefights, of blazing words, each opinion a bullet flaming to a target grown-ups could see, but not Joseph. Decisions based upon quarrels lost and salvation hanging tight by threads which would cut joyfully. To prove the only way to heaven's down an aisle, proclaiming Jesus a lightning strike of emotion. Aftermath of such bravado, stench of cold ash. Buzzwords bend hot iron rods of holy writ. Something in the balance did not make sense. A burn of faith in his bosom equaled any storm of words, but not a shelter against crosswinds of opinion, unholy slanders of his quiet Christ. He needed peace to prevail in his aching heart, not royals and turbu, lengths, arguments of who said what to who, and chapters of old battered Bibles,
where verses proving one way was right were underlined in red ink, flashed like black knives. Deity sees beginning and end from beginning. So how could a common team know a chorus sung low as a tabernacle choir of memories and so many lines running soft in rills of melody? Joseph would find day by day in common toil and bloody struggle his theme song beginning. Find the gods were planning how man could find a way to perfection, a way home to father and mother waiting quietly by a gate to eternity.
From Deus Ex Machina. So it begins, a question why he wants to know. Who could he go to when no one knew more than he, a boy perturbed beyond explanation? Deep down pandemonium of soul unexplained, perplexed by matter seeming far beyond him, concerned with the why of all philosophies of men, when no one seemed to know the why and how of why we are here, and why, if flesh has meaning beyond dust, it becomes nothingness. They who had more answers than questions questioned nothing, waited for others' answers. If man is made in God's image, why has he no body? Can empty mirrors see other mirrors in nothing more than nothing? It made no sense. Was flesh a spun mass of sin formed into being by a loving creator to be condemned for being? When the spring sparkles with rhododendrons, why do mockingbirds echo their little prayers? Seeking a grove he knows of, a spot of quietude, Joseph can hear the meadowlarks far afield of his father's farm, calling to him as if they know what no man knows for sure. Sure ceremonies of innocence before Eden, sure signs like clicks and swish of wings flittering amidst the branches, a temple of lucent silence broken only by chip and brush of leaf against leaf, occasional cicadas hymning, gleam of sunlight amid pure shadow. Here the Holy Spirit he seeks, beaming in blue cascades of sky, the fresh breath of a soft breeze, as if clearing away to heaven, a weft of quiet, a harp woven of interlaced threads of gestures, quick fingers strumming the surrounding hum of bees, mingling in flowers their soft-spoken joy. Being what they are, instruments of almighty knowledge, creation's beginning and foreknown weave, all he needs to know of heaven and hell.
Who does he speak to? When pastors say God stands by and watches what happens to snarls and cross intentions amongst lonely humankind, and striving to understand ancient tongues spoken in classic idiom, removed from everyday speech. So far removed, they speak in neo-Shakespearean tones no one understands, but all try to emulate. The boy considers he might make sense of this if he reads closely what God himself has to say. As he walks toward the grove, he remembers James's epistle. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. Simple enough, makes sense. A lot more sense than jabber he can't understand. The Bible says only God can tell him what he wants to know. So the answer's clear as a spring morning, 1820. He'll ask his Father in heaven what he should do. Joseph doesn't know any better. All the bitter precepts God has gone and lost to man, who now alone tries to figure out ancient scriptures of peoples lost to modern memory. These regrets fall upon innocent ears of a boy who knows his father, who knows his father does not lie to him, who answers question when he asks sincerely. He will be answered, which row should he plow, which furrow is most promising to bear fruit. Morning sun casts long shadows upon across the land. Disputations of raucous neighbors lie behind him. He finds a path in undergrowth, makes his way in silence, walks toward the grove he's chosen. No one knows the path, not even he, anticipates. He must find out as he sees lilies in lush clover, large trillium flowers blooming in early purple, pink, later on in age and time as all things grow and change, and all he knows is he does not know.
Joseph's special place, the one he knows by heart, he left an axe in a stump like a cleft of reflection. The very air in the grove that morning shimmers, bright sunlight through white curtains of cool birch, whitewood forest of his father's farm yet uncut, stands of hardwood, forest maples, hop hornbeam and beech and wild cherry, rise like thick about with ash, oak, hickory, elm canopies of aspen, and tree trunks grown wide around and white as Solomon's pillars. Joseph's arms cling to his sides like veins clasp these reaching trees standing dead, still while his breath becomes a sudden interim, holding in a beating heart at the core as if he's becoming like a tree in ages of growth, in outward rings, alive but stirring no movement to record life. It's like the verge of leaping into a cold stream to swim, knowing a shock of impact may be at once like slap of liquid ice or fierce undertow. Joseph feels a surge of anticipation as he kneels. No one knows what he's about to do, not even he. The only eyes upon him peek out in butterflies and quick blinks of squirrels playing hide-and-seek with their destinies and never see the teeth snap. He knows he's alone with whatever thundered in storms a year ago and beat against the glass. A clear day's promise may unwind an anguish of waiting. Answers never ticked out in clocks.
How do you pray? He wonders as he closes his eyes for a moment, knowing that you shut out the light of life, which may distract deep meditation, but how does he garble aloud the mix of words he's heard in churches, which seem so far from the quiet of this grove? His first prayer spoken. Quickly, he opens his eyes again and see and hear the familiar scene around him in faint rustling of leaves, but tiny creatures hiding like children. Shuddering black invades thick as doomsday. Not an absence of light, so much as liquid tar pouring down upon him all around his body, in bands of ebony and steel muscles tightening, a wrestling hold he's never heard of before. Wily cheetah's stranglehold of deadly intent, not the kind he knew and fended off for fun with his brothers, but savage endgame grip of fist and arm to crash inexorably his throat, pinging open power Joseph never knew of, rancid words of an extinct tongue unknown flatulated against his ears and nostrils, heavily breathing a horrid excremental extortion in scrambled tones of fierce excitement of rape, a kind of craving to die inside and suck its soul dry of hope or any human feeling left of love, a blankness of black spirit seizing his insides, merciless infestation of every ill ever known. This total attack struck unexpectedly as a storm. Right.
So again, this the tar and feathering, this section about what Joseph is experiencing physically. This total attack struck unexpectedly as a storm on a bright day, a tornado of impending death no choice left but to move or breathe another breath, no clear air ever again outside a grave, as if every bludgeon ever brought down upon an innocent child of God were suddenly brought to bear at one exact point, the crown of Joseph's head, sending exquisite shocks of static despair into his bosom, a feeling he had never known, as if he had carelessly cracked crystal jars of jet, ink, globs, blotting out bright sunshine he loved, as if he had crossed a line he never knew existed, to be damned for rules no one had told him of, as if he stirred a hornet's nest of demon wasps only to be consumed by fire ants of his nerves, as if he spoke the unspeakable by not speaking. So the universe crashed in about him, unaware of what he could ever know unless he asked. Before he could ascertain if he had gone mad or no, before he could figure out how very air turned iron, how ground rose up around him in steely cords, twisting bands, skulking morass, manifest hate. Your final end of despair, convoluted tar pit of ebony snakes, massive octopus of sleek, oily arms, catching him dead still. Meaningless pain, stasis, crushing beak of invisible evil, breathless to kill, telling him, all is lost. Abandon hope. Enter here.
How do I describe what only Joseph experienced? I'll try, Father, to speak in words that can't be said, nor spoken aloud in tones of mortal knowledge. A bottom of nothing pulled out below his knees, suddenly suspending him over a space-time black hole unknown nor even guessed at by anyone at all before men could know ether-locked visions. Unending black holes across a starry night inside centers of sheer energy only you, Father, know. We may be near to guessing a chink at the edge of the universe thou created can be what Joseph knew at the hands of a crass intelligence blotted out from your presence and damned to outer dark, who well knew Joseph threatened his blackness. The dots of light of Joseph's mind and soul shining as noonday sun, reflecting the source of all sun in thy creations, too vast for us to grasp at once, yet with Joseph's faith can find on bended knee. Poor poet that I am, I sigh aloud my hyperboles. But what can I say in presence of inexpressible glories of God, except with the language I know? Glories now known through Joseph's mind in view of heavens and multiplying star forms and creations unendingly brought about by almighty powers. While man's knowledge is grudgingly nudged out of facts he can see, the invisible properties of God's intelligence streak like shots in wires. Therefore, grasp them at your peril, man. They jolt the edges of eternity, and Joseph is cast into a chasm of black by the adversary to frighten him to death, to ward off the plan Lucifer feared, foreordained without his will or cooperation, but blooming in springtime verdure of the grove, to be retrieved by young Joseph without guile, who had only faith to lead him to places no man knows without the permission of him who knew beforehand this day.
In the last moment before he knew he would die, Joseph flashed upon his question, which called aloud in the deepest part of his soul to answer what was happening in man and himself that demanded recognition, that pled for the mercy of knowing where he was going, where he'd be at the moment of his last breath, falling into a black hole of the grave forever, or lifted by his loving Father to the newness of ever-knowing. A hush of motion lightly sweeps through the grove, like a hand brushes soot away from an ivory vase. The foul black haze evaporates in a fresh breeze. Joseph takes a deep breath, wonders if it really happened, or if he passed out in desperation of ever speaking a clear thought again in his voice. He coughs a couple of times to clear his throat, folds his hands before him as his mother taught, searches for words to say to his heavenly father, so no black entity would interfere, for entity it was. He bows his head and hopes for the best.
A sense of sudden warmth sends a chill of relief down Joseph's spine, as if he's at home forever. His father's and mother's arms tight around him. He blinks as the black vanishes from the grove. His eyelids feel like cracks in two crystal eggs, hidden baubles of Easter surprise and laughter, with the rays of risen sun igniting the world, or a flash of brightness inside the bright flare at a July 4 picnic, friends and family all around. Long shadows cast into hills and hollows glow molten white, a sense of love in a spoonful of milk when you're sick and mother feeds you tenderly. Father strains a lick of hair from your forehead and places his palms gently upon you to bless your place in life as being his beloved son. So it was with Joseph, as he cleared his eyes and glanced upward toward two figures standing in the air, lightly poised on tiny points of morning. Of what is the substance of God? For no man knows and lives if he sees unrighteously, nor I by my words, my epic reaching past my grasp, as if ice crystals formed briefly in patterns of infinity, a sight that Joseph beheld. Familiar figures, two of whom he saw as men wrapped in gleams of sharp sunlight, reflecting all at once the stars in heaven, wearing robes of moonglow and flowing rhythm, and even sun unbeknown of teeming rays and flares outbursting.
Mom, would you read this section
sure.
as well as the next? I need to
Could
read it.
He be seeing real personages he recognized? Were they wore bright, white, singular robes in sheets of deep flame, emerging all in a glance, an unknown brightness from inside of Joseph's eyes, as if centers of creation took on lights of clear streams in spring, the kind Joseph loved to fish for flashes, leaping in rippling rivers of intelligence made seeable in real seeming and tangible being, actual bodies shining in starbursts of crystal ice, visible as warm sunshine. Infinite complexity made seeable and simple to Joseph, a sense that somehow he knew them before this time, like a close companion's face seen briefly in the crowd, a flash of knowing the familiar bright eyes glancing his way after long absence and a quick recognition for another brief moment of sight resting on lives lived together in years of wending through days of loving. This was the feeling wrapping around him, clear clasp of delicate memory, like a child knows his family first. I like to think these were his fleeting thoughts. Joseph sees two forms forming in gleaming robes. He begins to perceive two persons being real as crystals creating inexplicably shattering bits and shapes and blending each into each, like spring takes winter snow and melts it into rocky edges and flowing forms of silver and green growth peeking through stuckness of winter, forced to release its grip, yet clutching its last freeze in spots melting. Does, do you want me to continue?
No, I'll see which one are you doing.
Okay.
Section one.
Yeah, okay, I'm doing this one.
No, he's doing one.
Does Joseph? Oh, Demi, excuse me, no. Her, excuse me.
Does Joseph identify a double sight as a dream? Forms forming more forms, a light in inner glow, glowing figures forming a glory between them as alike as father and son in a family resemblance, in the air above him, as if two impending clouds seen before on northern shores rumble forward, as if separate parts of the same person emerging, as if facing mirrors, facing mirrors, facing Joseph, as if he can, as if he between can see unending time and eternity. I've indicated what I think and believe Joseph saw. Yet brittle connections fall apart in man's speech. I fend off temptation to dazzle myself and others with brilliant insights and words of praise I value. Can I be humble and proud in the same breath, yet in one move bow low and thus survive pride? Can I say what I believe in words so beautified I set Hamlet straight and call up Ophelia's father, Polonius, to stutter iambics to camels in clouds? As a rumbling echo low inside a deep well, with white marbled sides around a space-time borehole of infinite depth and quietude, reverberating sound, a voice he knew but had never heard before now. Joseph, my son, this is my beloved son. Hear him.
Joseph, imagine Joseph hears his God in a rush of wind, hears slush of ashen sky impending doomtime, hears sunken rocks beneath a sheen of streams, hears caverns ringing deep blue through gleam of sky, hears waves of applause inside a marble dome, hears ice knives cutting thin cuneiform to slices, hears screams of incessant pleas of the innocent, hears nettles of light piercing brief thunderclaps, hears over din mingling pain and joy combining. Who was he that he should be so addressed by God as son, in the same breath as son of man himself? Who was Joseph to know what no man knew before, or if known and forgotten in windings of underground caves, stalactite ice, stalagmite mire, growing into mysterious towers, misunderstanding mankind, life beneath a brief life of a secret life in his mind, wondering what no man could know. Who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going now? A dream in daytime, he knew what was happening, yet no clue which way to go. So now, like a boy, asking directions home in a strange town where somehow he had lost his way, wandering far from a far place he had almost forgotten, but knew somehow where he had come from, knowing he had been sent on an errand to find his family, their heritage, as heir apparent in a maze of streets and paths with strange names. And he knew he must ask directions.
They smiled down in solemn loving understanding, as he knew so well from his father when he and his brothers needed a nudge of guidance. Fearful they had stepped over the line, but knew full well that their father knew them better than they themselves. So they weren't afraid. Such was Joseph's response. Rubbing his eyes as if gunpowder flashed invisible halos, rococo after images radiating sublime rings around the holy faces he saw once in a painting. These, he saw, were as no others he had ever seen. In rain he had seen lights gleam in water and seem a part of a shining surface, in little laps, rippling waves aloud in the least whispers fresh renewing glimmers, or of promises of full crops to come in, and dark fields outlying his father's fertile farmland. He could see two handsome faces of noble persons heretofore only imagined as his mother read to him stories of shining princes and kingdoms unending. Yet these faces were more than real, more familiar than he ever knew of men imagined or remembered. Real men he met and knew of in tangible forms of flesh and bone, like himself, for they had spoken to him, as now he heard these figures before him speaking, like silent lightning hung inside a roiling, majestic cloud of light, with yet a deep thunderclap of love to come, as though an enlightened cloud containing this lightning strike had yet to thunder gloriously.
Dared he speak? Would he be struck, as a standing oak might be, alone in a coming storm, as he had seen once riven once with glory, cracked to shreds and sticks? Yet this was why he was here, why he came to the grove alone, to ask his father a question his father would answer. Gathering all his courage, he spoke up as he always did when confronted with unsettled questions in his quest of faith and belief, longing for an answer to come somehow from the powers before him in light. Joseph got hold of himself enough to know one thing, that he had stirred up a storm of glory in his grove. Hoping not to stutter or shame himself with doubt, he spoke aloud, maybe too loud for a quiet moment. Who's right? They all say different things. I just can't understand them because they're all talking at once. Who's got it wrong? Because I want to do what you want me to. Somebody's got to be right. They can't be all right at the same time, can they? Who's right? As a distant stroke of lightning followed by thunder, this glorious person sounded aloud one low word. None. Then Joseph heard words remembered henceforward. They draw near to me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They teach for doctrines the commandments of men, having a form of godliness, but they deny the power thereof.
So far, he had wondered his question only to himself. How could this person know his very heart's core? His puzzlement, which church or which exact sect to join, there were so many of them, and all of them as great as he was obscure. Grand titles of Christendom, ringing bells repeating low tones, lo, here, across vast religious landscapes of Christ, lo, there, Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist, Catholic, Unitarian, not to say help in private preachers preaching. This desperation born of black despair thrust on him just moments before, this quizzical fear like cracking ice beneath his feet, his eyesight glazed with rending streaks and flashing lights, hideous, dizzying indecision, all this frenzy of his soul which brought him here to his grove, fraught with doubt and impending doom, turned suddenly calm as spots of cool fern growing. Suddenly, all this panic building in his mind vanished. He could see who stood there in silver, gold, and green. Double in glory they shone, two beams down upon his grove, with gentle greenery all about them, pure and undisturbed, no ruffled glare, shadows flickering, dark tongues compounded, yellow and licking wood, no evergreen fire or night flaming earthly sparks, nor moon nor stars melt white on leaves of birch. Noonday sun never shone as bright as these lights, shining more brightly than fire ever seen by man. Blue, glimmering flame in icy daytime nightlight. Blue, glimmering flame in icy daytime nightlight.
miraculous it seemed to him. And miraculous it was. Had he known before his query would fetch up pure fire like this, he might have stayed home, afraid, never knowing what lay behind careening screens of just plain things he knew in everyday busy plod, hard toil with his two rough hands, twisting a living from land, portraits not yet painted by axe and spade, dreams cut out of dirt, precise furrows and farmland, venturing far as heaven, beyond morning sunshine.
Any questions from the audience?
It's hard, I'm sure, to... one of the things that's difficult in a way, because we are so attuned to reading, that the oral tradition, the aural tradition is kind of lost to us. And so we don't have ears to hear as our ancestors did when the old English Shopes sat around and talked and read poetry, or when Homer, all of this extemporaneous, they called it the word horde, that horde of words and images inside the poet who could stand and speak and the audience could hear it weaving each time anew.
And they memorized it.
And they memorized it, yes. So you had this... this vast word hoard of words and images and rhythms. So I think it's kind of it's hard but refreshing for us to try and concentrate enough to pick up some of this when we're so unused to that. I grew up listening to the radio, especially on Saturday mornings. And one of the nice things about hearing things is that it allows you to use your imagination in a way that the visual image is somebody else's imagination, whereas the hearing it allows you to some extent that experience. But anyway, we wanted anyone who had a question for Ron about how he composed this poem, or what he, now that he's finished the first third of it, to gird up his loins for the next two-thirds.
how long have you been writing it?
It began with I guess it's 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
4 years.
Four?
Yeah.
4 years.
And how did you first conceive of it? How did it come to you?
I decided to take a form and just start writing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the form I chose was the 9-line Spenserian stanza, only I put it in free verse, so I had 9 lines. So I just started talking, but instead of trying to think of words, I was thinking of sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So I followed these sounds all the way through and kept going with sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And these sounds turned into what I was thinking. That's the best way I can explain it. It's a far different method than sitting down with a piece of paper and writing what you think in good grammar. I sat down and I tried to catch the sounds I was hearing in words, and then see what I said. That's the way I wrote it.
And did you parse the stanza lines? Did you go back?
Yeah,
and count
of course.
Them?
I went back and shaped it up as best I could.
Any of the other readers have any questions or observations?
I was impressed with when did you, Dr. Jolly? Were you the one who said that it was the tarring and feathering scene? Because when I read it, I felt like it was the presence of Satan in the grove. But then I considered the fact that they intermingled somehow. The future came into the present of that moment, of every fight that he seemed to have with the adversary. was described in certainly in the metaphors of someone being tarred and feathered, but it was also a very, very well constructed moment in the poem. I guess it had to be. I'm sure we all felt the coldness and the depth. Like me too. I felt you doing it. That moment it had so much depth to it, and I hadn't considered the fact that it was also with the persecutions and everything that he was going to encounter. I don't know if you want to speak to that.
Now, one of the things that you get a sense of in the broad scope of the poem that comes across a little in this section is the kind of mindscape that you appear to be working with, Ron. So it's almost as though all things are time present. And
yes.
You move back and forth between historical events without any real sense of obligation to the timeline.
Exactly. And as I was trying to say, by beginning with quantum gospel, by beginning with the quantum rather than with the arithmetic or with A, B, C, D, or 1, 2, 3, 4, mm-hmm. by getting into the quantum, you're beginning to say, when this happens, this happens. And there's really no space between them, and that's the mystery of the quantum.
Yeah.
So I was trying the whole time to if this happened, that happened, and it really astounded me what happened over here.
Terrell Gibbons used the term the collapsing of sacred space, which I think is a wonderful image, and which works certainly. I'm not sure. I don't think he intended it there, but on the quantum level, that's really what's happening is the collapsing of time and space, sacred time and space.
Mike Quinn was one of the early readers of that we sent the poem out to, and he drew attention to the kind of lack of a sense of obligation to historicity per se, and said that at first as a historian it troubled him, but then when he began to realize what was happening, it intrigued him more. So I think that's very interesting.
Orson Whitney, who well over 100 years ago observed that the time would come when Mormonism would have its own Shakespeare's and Milton's, sorry about that, tried himself to write an epic. And what, you know, I think... Dr. Johnson said a very sexist statement, but nevertheless in that day true, a woman speaking in church is like a dog standing on its hind legs. What surprises you is not that it's not done well, but that it's done at all, which is what I think of in terms of I said it was sexist. I said it was sexist. But it's a prelude. It's a prelude to Orson F. Whitney attempting to write an epic. What surprises you?
There's a point to this.
That's the worst analog.
What surprises you?
I had to cut it immediately.
What surprises you is not that it's not done well, but that it was done at all. But what is surprising is to try and imagine an apostle today trying to write an epic poem instead of finding fault with.
What pleases me about this group is that as long as Ron and Bob are here, I will not be the most offensive person in the room.
You commented about in the last session about Eugene England as a mythic character.
Yeah.
I was thinking as I was listening to this, this is the world of sound. This is the world of heroism. This is the world. But it wasn't the same thing as saying Joseph is a mythic character. That's a different way.
What's
the difference between hearing this and what you were talking about?
One of the things that has occurred to me about what Ron has accomplished is I wrote a long, dull paper a long time ago, but the historians thought a lot of it. And it was. It was about Joseph Smith interpreted as fulfilling the martyred hero archetype.
Yeah.
And I went through the various points in his life, and Carl Keller objected because he thought that I didn't much care whether it was history or legend or myth. I just took all of them and saw how well it suited the typology of the Christ, or of George Armstrong Custer, for that matter. All of these martyred heroes that satisfy these requirements. And then I asked the question, was Joseph perhaps participating? And for instance, we know that he asked to be taken to the upper room, which helped to satisfy the typology. And at the end, I then said, well, really what I've done is pose more questions, and it now is for someone else to come behind and answer these things. Well, no one did, until it seems to me this poem, which very much elevates Joseph to that kind of mythic level, and I don't know any place I've read where you get more of the sense of this Arthurian quest, you know, this sense that there's a sword about to be pulled from the stone. And I think it's especially true because he uses colloquial speech and imagines Joseph responding as a boy would in an unquestionably heroic circumstance. I think it's pretty remarkable.
Really super. Yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you,
Ron, for indulging us. And
Is this accessible?
It is.
Where do you,
he said, is it accessible? It is on the web, right? Is the poem accessible?
Oh, yeah, I'm putting it on the web. I'll put it on normanepic.com. Yes.